Good morning, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat. Today, I feel a bit rusty, to be honest with you. I haven't done any recording for the past 48 hours. I normally do this on a daily basis. Today, I'm going to have to, you know, rejuvenate my rhythm here a little bit. And my guest today is a three-time startup founder with over 15 years of sales, product development. In the latest venture, he set out to do something most entrepreneurs avoid: disrupt a category that hasn't changed in decades. Oscar Hedaya is the founder of Space and creator of Safe Space, the Space Safe, product bringing modern technology to one of the most overlooked corners in the customer market, in the consumer market. Oscar, welcome to the Localization Fireside Chat, all the way from Israel. And I wish you lots of safety down there. And make sure, as we record this, do what you need to do. As we record this, one sitting in Canada, the other person is sitting in war zone. I truly appreciate the time that you're giving me today, and hopefully everything is safe on your end.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, so I'm visiting. So if we do have to run, then you will run with me. We'll run to a bunker, and we can just continue the have a little fun. But thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, Oscar. So before we get into it, if you don't mind, as we say on this channel, Oscar, everybody's got a story. Why don't we start with this one? What's your story? What got you here?
Oh, okay. So very simply put, like you said before, I've been in product development for nearly 15 years. And I've created some really cool, unique products. And I had a situation in my family that we needed a safe because of a theft. And I couldn't really find anything out there that I liked. And that's when, like, the aha moment where I scratched my head, I was like, hey, this is my bread and butter. I make product and I know what I want. I couldn't find anything out there. And that's it. I created this awesome product.
So, excellent.
Oh, and yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's so funny. I'm so like used to just talking about my product all the time that I didn't realize that, like, we didn't really say what it is. But the Space Safe, it's a smart safe. It's the only safe in the world that has cameras. It has a touch screen. It has tamper sensors. So if somebody touches it, it moves it, anything that has to do with the safe. And then it has app notifications. So you can think like Ring doorbell, but for safes. And that's how we set ourselves aside from anybody else. And so, yeah.
I was just going to say, Oscar, from your point of view, when an aha moment comes up, I'm always fascinated by the aha moment. You know, was there a situation where, you know, you absolutely felt like, oh, I need a safe, but these things, what was the situation that led you to that? If you don't mind explaining.
No, absolutely. We had a theft in the family and we didn't have a safe. And
where were you living at the time, Oscar? Was that in Israel or here on this side?
No, in New York. I actually live in Miami. I'm just visiting Israel, but I was living in New York at the time.
Okay.
And I was in I lived in a walk-up building, and so sometimes the front door wouldn't lock, and then upstairs we never locked our door, and I guess somebody knew that, or somebody came in, they stole some of the valuables that we had, and we realized, like, hey, we need a safe, you know.
and on that level, when this happened, I guess we always talk about this on the channel here, is, you know, a product that solves a problem. So basically you've identified a problem and you found a solution for it. What entrepreneurs tend to happen sometimes, that's the best approach to creating a product or a service. You identify a problem and you create a solution for it. But what tend to happen is, and I've seen it over and over again, is in, you know, because I come from a tech background, it's a bunch of engineers gets together, God bless them, and they create something. And I say, okay, so who's going to buy that? I say, no, yeah. We create it because it's cool. Well, cool does not equal commercialization. And I think that's what everybody intend to do with their product, unless they're just creating it to look pretty.
Yeah. Yeah. And I totally agree with that. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons why so many startups fail, right? Is because sometimes they create an awesome product, but when you think of it like, but who's going to buy that? You know what I mean? Like, so, and it doesn't mean that they didn't create something amazing or that they didn't put a lot of love and energy into it. It just, sometimes people who start businesses don't really think about like the customer. Like, can I actually make a business out of this? Do people really need this? Right. And that's kind of the question is, if you're selling a high ticket price, if you're selling a high ticket item, it's, hey, do I need this? If it's a very, very low ticket item, it's like, hey, that's cool. It would be cool to spend 15, 20 bucks on this thing, you know? So that's kind of the issue that a lot of entrepreneurs have. Yeah.
And in your product, it seems to have identified, like in the smart safe area, you seem to have identified a stagnant category, because I would assume, you know, that entire segment, it was more of a box lock, put it in place where nobody can see it, that kind of thing. But you've taken that to a completely different level. Like, what's the pros and cons to that in a digital world that we live right now? I did a couple of podcasts on cybersecurity. Things are not easy out there.
Yeah. Yeah. So great question. It's funny because, like, you know, when you buy a safe traditionally, right, 99% of safes sold today are traditional safes, right? You buy this big black box or whatever, this metal box, you buy it, you put things inside and you kind of forget about it until you go and you need something out of there, right? So you really never know if something happens to your valuables, again, unless you go there. And so what sets us really apart with our safe, we're not just providing protection, but we're also providing visibility, control, and live notifications, right? So if something, God forbid, did happen, whether somebody breaks into your house or if you have a housekeeper who just, you know, is playing around with your safe, that's when
curious, Oscar.
Yeah. It's funny because, like, we're part of this digital world right now, like you're asking, right? We're connected. We are a connected product, but everything today is connected, right? You have robot vacuums, you have like a Schlage front door opener, you know? So it's not just anymore like one or two items or a Ring doorbell. There's so many different products that are connected to the internet, right? And so it's funny because, like, I get asked a lot this question about cybersecurity around the product, right? And so something that we have are cameras, right? But you take a robot vacuum that has cameras also. You take a Ring doorbell that has cameras also. You take cameras in general, you know, those have cameras. So, you know, are we less secure than all those other products? No, not at all. Actually the opposite, you know, because we have to take into consideration this extra layer of security for safes, we have to make sure that we have the cybersecurity aspect, number one. But so if somebody tries to hack into it or whatever it is, that's number one. And then number two is we also need to make sure that, because this is a physical product, you know, you don't want anybody gaining access to the physical side also, right? So there's a lot of different layers that our team has to take into consideration when they built out the entire architecture of the product.
Absolutely. And especially when you're putting it into the hands of consumers, this is not the selected business application. This is going to be going into the masses kind of thing. And we'll talk a little bit about, you know, the where you are right now in terms of commercialization. How far along are you? What is the future for the product development? We'll talk about those for a second. But before I get to that, I have a question for you. Sorry. You're a three-time founder. So what was the first two-time that you tried to found a company, or you founded a company in the beginning? What did they teach you? What that experience taught you before you got to the third one? And they say, like, third time is a charm. I'm not sure if that's the case in your world, but.
It was not the case in my world. All of the other two startups were also phenomenal startups. We sold amazing product, and the number one thing that, for me, I'm a Gemini, and one of the things that I like to do is stand out, right? If you look up my birth calendar and my birth time and all, I don't know, all that stuff. But if you look at that, one of the biggest things is I like to stand out. I like uniqueness. And you could see that from this kind of product, right? Nobody created this, and I'm the first one to create this unique safe. But it's always been like that with the other two startups. What I learned from the other two startups was really, number one, I had partners in those other startups. This startup, I don't have a partner, you know? So when you're working with other people, sorry, let me go back one second. We tend as people to always think that we are right with everything we do, right? You think that like your moral calendar, your moral calculator, everything is based on what you think is correct, right? And so when you have another partner in a business, you can no longer kind of think like that. You know, you got to think a little more like, hey, there's another person here. And I'm not married, but it helps me, you know, having been in a startup founder for the last 12, 13 years already, it's helped me a lot with relationships because it's not just you anymore. It's somebody else you have to take into consideration. And you have to think like, hey, not just like I'm pulling the trigger on this, but what are your thoughts, right? This is my background. My background is XYZ. Your background is ABC. This is what I think. This is what you think. Do you think we need these features? Do you think we need to buy 10,000 pieces of this? You know, so for me, that was one of the biggest things that I learned is Oscar as a startup founder is the one, you know, pulling the trigger, but it's not just my money or it's not just my business. And for that, and you're not an employee because you get to make those decisions, right? But every decision you make affects a long line of other people, whether it's your partner or the people working in your company for you guys.
Yeah. Now, I assume like when you have a partner, Oscar, and I've seen it in before conversation and even experience myself, is every individual partner has its own expertise, which creates a lane that you need to stick to. And but of course you're talking, of course you're coordinating, but that lane maintenance, I think it will become a little bit more of a challenge, especially when you have more than one partner. If you have like one partner, it's easy to manage. When you have like two, three partners and each one of them has a different lane that they need to be in, then all of a sudden we get into an intersection somewhere and all hell breaks loose in some cases, not always. I mean, of course, there's a lot of successful partnerships out there, but to illustrate to validate your point, being an independent and sole entrepreneur and founder, it's much easier to manage. You're only accountable for yourself versus all the other conversation you probably need to manage. Am I correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And so one of the things that you were saying, you're totally right. I mean, if you take like, if you're taking a three founder company, you know, you probably have one guy who's the product developer. You have another guy who's the sales guy, and you have the third guy who's the finance guy, right? That's usually how it works when you're bringing in three different partners. And it's funny because like the product developer will always, usually they're designers and they don't always take into consideration what something will cost, right? And that's something we were kind of talking about earlier. The sales guy is the guy who says like, hey, I know I could sell it for this amount. And the finance guy is usually the guy saying, you guys are spending too much money. Nobody's going to buy this. Right? So it's funny because yes, there is that intersection, but to have those three key founders is also, not every founder has those skill sets, you know? So if I was ever to recommend three different types of founders together, those are the three that I would recommend because it kind of encompasses the entire company. And as a solo founder, you have a lot of those other things that those other founders would be handling, just that sits on your back, right? At the end of the day, like I have employees that work for me, but I still have to review and look at everything that they're doing. My background is not finance. I know how to handle the finance, but I don't want to be doing the finance as my main job. Right. So it's funny that you brought that up. Yeah.
Yeah, you know what? You just reminded me. I just started a new company in November, just 2025, and it's just a brand new company. It's a company. I mean, I'm a consultant, and I'm trying to promote some of my expertise out there. And just on that front, I mean, I'm not creating a hardware, or I'm not creating. Maybe I'm creating a software now, but hardware, I'm not creating this logistical nightmare of collecting parts and designing and manufacturing and, you know, manufacturing parts in certain country and assemble them in another country. That's a major logistical problem that you're trying to solve, and you're doing it on your own. That's pretty, you know, and you mentioned something very interesting, because there is, you're right, there is no one individual that can contain or can say that I have a lot of all these skills, I have them all embedded in one individual, unless there's something I don't know about. You can't be the IT person, you can't be the designer, you can't be the finance or the HR person, unless you don't want to sleep 24 hours a day and you want to do all these things. I'm not saying you can't learn them, but there's no time to sleep after you do this. So that entire principle of 1 mile wide and 1 inch deep becomes dangerous at some point. Am I correct?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's important also, that's why you need to hire people, you know, and going back to what you were saying, like, yeah, you could try to learn it, but we all as people we have things that we're amazing at, right? Each individual is amazing in one area, right?
Yep.
You are not going to be amazing in some other area, but
correct.
You want to make sure, even if you try to learn it to save money or whatever you're going to do, you're not going to be the best in that. The best thing to do is hire somebody that would be the best in that, so you don't waste your time and you focus on the things you're best at. You know?
That's right. If it's going to take you 6 months to do something, hire somebody that will do it in a week.
Yeah, exactly.
So tell me, before you went into the actual product development, was there a research phase that you went through, or you done your own? Did you hire a research company, or you did it yourself? How did you get to that validation, if you will?
Yeah, I did not do I did not hire a research company. It's kind of like what I've always done in my past, was always like do research myself, look into it. I'm very good at product development and sales, so I've sold to the major retailers of the world. You know, like Walmart, Target, Costco, Canadian Tire, Argos, whichever company you could think of, I probably sold them a product, you know? And so the research for me has always been like, hey, as a consumer, because it's so funny. My second cousin always laughs. He says, you are the ultimate consumer. Anytime he needs to buy something, he asks me. And the way I decide whether I want to buy something is, hey, I'm looking at the features, I'm looking at the physical design as well of the product, and then whatever the price point is it worth the value, right? That's kind of how you decide if something is worth buying, right? The best companies are products that sell the masses, not just a high-end customer or not just somebody who goes horseback riding, you know what I mean? Like, if you're able to have a very wide array, that's really the best.
You know, I want to let Sean on something you just said, because most companies, they try to find a niche and they play in it, right? And I keep telling people that specific niche that you're looking for, that, just to illustrate to people who are listening to this, what I mean by niche is, if you decided, for instance, I want to sell product A and I only want to sell it on the block that I live on, that's your market. That's what the sandbox that you drew for yourself, and that's where are you going to play. If anything changes in that small sandbox that you drew for yourself, which be it your market, well, guess what? Your raison d'etre disappeared. The product disappeared. The company needs to fold or go figure it out at a different level. And I always encourage people like who are in service providing, they provide services or professional service to others, make sure that you draw a parallel across all the sectors. Make sure that you're providing something horizontal, not yes. specific to a specific area, unless you have a different plan. I don't know, but horizontal services, I agree with Oscar, horizontal products or horizontal services that go to the masses have a better and bigger chances of success and longevity in the terms of the business model that they establish.
Yeah. And so something that you earlier said was that this is perfect for consumers, right? You didn't say that word for word verbatim, but you said something like that, right? But what's funny is every single time I tell somebody about the company or the product, everybody has something else to say. You know, one person will say like, oh my God, this is perfect for people's homes. Another guy will say, this is perfect for hotels. You know, another guy will say, this is perfect for the cannabis industry because they use cash, or Airbnbs. You know, everybody has a different viewpoint. And this goes back to what we were saying, like I brought up before, is like, you always think you're right or whatever, but there's so many different views. And I want to say something that's, I think is so important to the listeners is, you know, the biggest issue that I see that people make, and I help a lot of people out who are starting in startups also. I try to give back, you know, for other founders. And one of the things that I see that people do all the time is they take their TAM, right? They take their addressable market and they assume like, hey, water, for instance, right? Like there's 8 billion people in the world. That means we could sell our water to 8 billion people, you know, but that's not the way it works, you know? And you brought up before, like you live on this block and if you're selling to just those people on the block, like you could have maybe 10 people, 20 people. I don't know how many people live on that block, but what people's mistake usually is they assume that 100% of those people will be the purchasers of their product. When in reality, you know, whenever you're doing a financial model or you want to look at your projections or assumptions, is you have to take like a low, 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 low hanging fruit number, because, you know, you're not the first person to sell water or this product. You're not. Most of the time, this already exists. You know, you take me, for instance, I'm selling a safe. Safes have been around for thousands of years, right? So I'm not going to be selling every single person, even though everybody should have a safe in their home or their hotel or in their office, wherever you want to put it. But, you know, it's, you have to think like, okay, my thought process is how many people need a new safe? That's number one. And number two is how many people would be willing to pay more for this safe for tech, right? And that's kind of like where you have to narrow down the numbers a lot more, because even though there's 330 million people in the US and there's over 140 million homes, it doesn't mean every house is going to be my customer, right? And if I get even 500,000 homes, I would still be very happy, and everybody else should also, right? So I think it's very important when people are putting together their business model or their projections that they think more of like a realistic number. And I've spoken to a lot of investors before, and that's something that they all complain about, you know, is every founer thinks that they are going to sell 100% of that market.
Yep. I've seen a lot of business plans where the revenue numbers are a hockey stick. And I just keep saying, look, really? Is this like wishful thinking or what?
They don't know. They don't know, you know, but you need experience to know, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
Or you also need to be a realist, because some people aren't realistic either, right? And I find that like, it's funny because this is the separation between like a designer and a sales guy. A sales guy usually knows how much he could sell based on, or the price that something will sell for based on like his experience doing the sales and going to his customers. Where the designer may say like, oh no, we need this. Oh no, we, you know, it'll sell. Don't worry. But like at the end of the day, you know, you kind of need all of these little things.
So there is the build it and they come idea, and there is the sales guy who makes it happen. So the rainmakers come in and they do the sales versus the engineer who says, I built it. They must, you know, I got this interesting story. I got to tell you for the audience, maybe that's interesting for you too. It's history now, so I can talk about it. It is not a secret anymore. It was beyond, but that happened in 1999. So time has passed now. And there was a formidable number of engineers working for a company no longer exists. It's called Nortel Networks in Canada. You probably, most of our listeners familiar with Nortel Networks. And they were developing a product called the OC768. And the OC768, for those of you who are not familiar with this, it's a telecom card that goes inside of a telephone switch. Back in the days, used to be called the passport switch. They're still around, but they're used for various reasons now. And the OC768, you consider it as the biggest fiber optic pipeline you can ever imagine, to a point where when they were developing it, I was the guy who was selling the test beds for these telecom equipments. So I was directly involved in, you know, talking to these engineers about what they need in terms of their testing equipment. So through the testing, through the conversations, come to find out they're developing the product, etc. And my question was, who are you going to sell it to? Oh, everybody would buy it. So continued the conversation down the road just to see how this is going to evolve after I made my sale and it's fine. And they ended up doing a presentation to a high-level executives in Bell, I remember. That's the telecom, the big provider here in Canada. And the feedback came to say, so you mean to tell me I buy one of these cards, I'll put it in Winnipeg, which is our middle, the country kind of a city, and one-third of its capacity will handle the entire internet traffic in Canada. That's how big this thing was. Yeah. So how many of those are you going to sell? One? Two, three, it is not for the masses.
Yeah.
I think that's to illustrate, develop something that people can buy versus develop something because you can.
Yeah. And it's one of the reasons I love like crowdfunding. You know, crowdfunding, you don't have to spend a ton of money.
Did you use crowdfunding, Oscar? Did you use crowdfunding?
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
How did that work? Can you talk about your experience?
Yeah, of course. So it's kind of funny because like I came up with this product. I thought it was a winner product, and I had probably spent about $50,000 getting like to where I needed to be before I put it on the crowdfunding site. So that was my like my sunk cost to see, hey, would this be worth it? Would people be willing to pay for it? Right? I was willing to spend $50,000. To see if this was a viable company. And so that was my cost. I went on Kickstarter and we sold almost $1 million between Kickstarter and Indiegogo. So for me, and I was in the top like 0.3% of all campaigns, which means like it's a winner. You know, it's a winner product. People are willing to pay for this. So now that people are willing to pay for this, instead of just having this like concept up here that I put $50,000 to as just like a concept, that's when like I took it, I developed it, and we continued on. But yeah,
I was just going to ask you for crowdfunding, how does it work? For those of our audience who are not familiar with crowdfunding, how does it work? Not because we want to talk about crowdfunding today, but just some inventors out there or some developers out there may be interested in just in summary, you don't have to go down the level of details. How does it work? Do you pay the money back? Is there an interest on it? How does it work?
Yeah, so usually you have like two types of, you go to Kickstarter.com, let's say, or Indiegogo, and there's a ton of other crowdfunding campaign websites. But let's say you go to one of these two websites, those are the biggest, and then you decide, you tell them like, hey, this is either a product or a service or something, like there's different categories. Now, for me, because it was a safe, you know, it's a product. Now, you go on, you create a new campaign, and then you create a page. And on this page, you talk about the product, you talk about everything that it could do, you show pictures, you create a video. And then after that, if you want people to back the project, right, there's two types of backers. There's people who say, I don't want to buy one, but I like the product and I want to give money for that. So it's almost like a donation. That's one type of person. And the other one is somebody who says, hey, I like this product. I want to buy it. And usually you give them a discounted rate. So let's say it's 20%, 30%. Every campaign editor decides on what they want to give as a discount. But the reason you give a discount is they're buying into the dream, right? So by buying into the dream, you're saying, hey, thank you for being an early investor. And in in exchange for your money, I'm going to give you this product when it's finished, and I'm going to give you this discount. And so after that, you do a lot of marketing, you send emails, you put it on advertising on like Instagram, TikTok, whatever you want to do.
Yeah, but I know you have a big following on Facebook and Instagram. You're doing a great job on the social media. Is it helping?
Yeah, I mean, look, honestly, it's funny because like I like to say, you can't skin the cat on everything the same way. You know, so what's good for me isn't good for you. What's good for you isn't good for the next person. You know, so I recommend everybody find their own way. You know what I mean? And for us specifically, it's important for me to say this, is when we did our campaign for Kickstarter, we worked with about 6 or 7 different advertising companies. And all of them stunk. And we spent tens and thousands of dollars. And then we found one that was incredible. And, you know, that's what helped us gain our traction. So really, you have to see what's best for your company, you know?
You got to see what works. Now, from a product itself, the Space Safe, Oscar, you mentioned earlier like a little bit about features and functionality of the product. Let's talk a little bit about that. And I also would like to know, where is the product being made? Do you have like your own factories? Is this like subcontracted to somebody? How does that work?
Yeah, so we don't have our own factories. I would never recommend most people to have their own factories. The reason is it's just this extra high cost that you have to take into consideration. It's not really worth doing. Not to mention, unless you're building out, right, I'm talking to you from my 15 years of experience, but unless you're working your factory 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year, which is a full-time production, you shouldn't own your own factory, right? Because then there's no benefit. Like if you're doing production runs, maybe 2 weeks of the month, you would be losing money if you owned your factory, right? I recommend almost everybody to use outsource, find a factory that does something similar. For us, we sell safes. So it's either metal factories or safe factories. And that was the direction we went in. And so we have 3 different factories around the world that we work with, depending on where we want to where we want to manufacture and ship the safes.
So one thing comes to my mind when you're doing the factory outsourcing, Oscar, is the intellectual property right. How do you maintain that?
Honestly, it depends where you're manufacturing, right? I hate to say this. I don't trust the Chinese. I've been doing business with them for over 15 years. But you could ask anybody, right? You could ask Mr. Wonderful, Kevin O'Leary says it all the time. You know, he doesn't trust the Chinese either. Even if you sign contracts with these people, they still will try to take your product and just put a different logo on it, you know? So how do we protect ourselves? This is our warning. We're going to have to go into the bunker now.
Oh, is it your warning? Okay, sorry about that. For the audience, Oscar,
so
you got your warning?
Yeah, I'm going to take everybody. Yep. Okay, excuse me. I'm in an Airbnb, so this is not the prettiest.
Take your time. Take your time.
Okay.
Be safe.
All right. All right, and you guys could see the way this closes.
Check this out.
This is real experience. All right. Sorry, I moved the camera a little.
That's okay. Don't worry. I'm good. Are you in a safe place?
Yeah. I'm in a safe room now. I'm in a bunker. I'm lucky enough to have this Airbnb that I'm staying in has a bunker in the apartment. Most homes here do not. So most homes don't even have it in the basement. You usually have to run a block or two
to get to somewhere safe.
And sometimes you have 90 seconds to run into a bunker. Yeah, and sometimes it's
stay safe, my friend. Minutes,
stay, you know? So stay safe. We're good for now.
So should we continue the conversation or should we pause? Okay.
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah, no. I'm perfectly fine to continue. So you were asking about the intellectual property. I mean, look, for if what my recommendation for everybody is, make sure you sign a contract with the factory, you know. For me, I try anytime I'm working with a factory, I try to make sure also the contract has arbitration in there and not the local courts of the country. The reason is, if you ever really do need to sue them, it probably won't work out, but you have a better chance with arbitration than you do with like Chinese courts, right? But yeah, that's number one. Number two, for us specifically, we have, we didn't talk about features, but we have a touch screen on our feature and on our safe. And because we have a touch screen, we actually built out an entire operating system. So we have an operating system for our safe. And so everything is developed in-house. And that's something that we make sure that the factory doesn't have. We also, and you also asked in the beginning about our supply chain. You didn't really ask, but you said it. And I was shocked that you knew. But our supply chain, big pain in the butt, right? We have over 100 different components and they're coming from different places. I would probably say about 30 are coming from different factories, and then 70 plus come from the safe factory. You know, so whenever we're sending anything to, So what we do is we hire the safe factory to manufacture the safe, and then we send all these other products that we source to the safe manufacturer, right? So the safe manufacturer doesn't know where we buy what. They don't know anything, right? They're just getting a box of supplies. And so by doing this, if they really wanted to knock us off, or if they wanted to copy us, it makes it a little more difficult. And that's how you kind of,
because that's a worry, right? So, I mean, you invested a lot of time and effort in making something, creating something that it, you know, the industry or the market does not have. And then when you get to the production phase, you know, it'd be disheartening to see the product is either messed with or get copied, et cetera. So you don't want that. And you're right, building some guardrails around the entire process is very important as developing the product in some cases.
Yeah, of course. I mean, for us, I'll give you an example. It took us about 3.5 years to develop this product. It should have taken 2, but we got into bed with the wrong people. But we also spent over $1 million developing this product, the software, the back end. You know, everything that we've put into development, you're talking about a lot of time and money. So if we're the ones who spend the time and money to do it, and then somebody else just comes off and copies you because you didn't protect it well enough.
Now, let's talk a little bit, if you don't mind, Oscar, about the, when I think about the product initially, you know, you mentioned earlier in the conversation that safes have been around for thousands of years, but they've never been upgraded to the level that you've upgraded it. So bringing modern technology, actually, what does it actually mean in the category that you're in the product category that you're in? And what is the delta, if you don't mind, between what existed and what you built? And how is the market reacting to all this? Because when I take, let's say, you know, I mean, for the consumers or for the audience out there, if I take like a dumb hammer in my hand and I'm just using that hammer all the time, and then somebody comes into me and say, hey, I've got a better, smarter hammer for you. But the hammer's been used for thousands of years. We've used different formats of hammers, wooden, metal, et cetera. Yeah. But then somebody comes in, put an operating system on it, put a touchscreen on it, add a few intelligence to it. And how is the consumer behaving to that? Are they, do they need to be trained on this? Are they operating it quickly? Do you have a response team that can walk them through it? Do you have like education to that? Sorry, too many things in one.
Yeah, so... No. But you know what? The first question was the best, because you kind of asked me first, like, you know, what's kind of sets us apart versus what was already out there in the market. And we are the first people to have a touch screen on our safe. Just to give you a concept of what that means, you could think about like every other safe. The furthest that they've ever gone is a digital keypad, right? So you want to come into your safe and you push these little buttons, right? That's all you have. You have a fingerprint reader a digital keypad.
Yeah, and by the
and a
way,
key.
when those are
Those are
in
your
those are in the
features. There's
hotels, by the
nothing
way. They
more
put
that
them in
you get.
hotels, and there's a big label on them. Do not leave anything valuable inside. That's supposed to be a safe. I'm sorry.
You don't even want to get me started on that, but we could talk about that after. But so really what we've done, because we have this touch screen, we built out an operating system. And just imagine, I mean, you and I, we both know this, but you go 30 years back 30 years ago, and
Yes.
we had, you remember the
Yeah.
flip phone, like
Motorola.
a cellular phone that was a flip phone. You couldn't do anything on that thing, right? You had a couple little buttons, very, very few options and features. And then now, if you take like the iPhone, for instance, you could do anything you want, right? The features are endless. Anything that you want is in front of your face. So, and so in terms of like features, we have a forgot pin feature. So if you forget your pin, you have a way to reset the pin. That's number one. Again, maybe not for you and I in our age, but maybe my grandmother wants it, Another feature we have is panic pin. So if somebody is holding a gun to your face and they say, open the safe, you could open the safe with a special unique pin code, and that pin code will unlock the safe and then send an emergency message out. These are things that you cannot do with other safes because they don't have a screen so that you can't see anything. What else? We have 2FA in our safe. We have multiple users. So, it's funny because you said before this is perfect for consumers, but we actually have enterprise companies that work with us that, let's say, have 1,000 safes out there, and they're able to see all of their safes in one portal that
Oh,
we
that's
offer.
next level
So
stuff.
they go to this website, they log in. Yeah, it's next exactly. It's next level stuff. And what we've done is we've created. We didn't just build a safe. We redefined what safes should be. Again, you take all these features. No other safe company has this. And so we sell these enterprise companies. And
I
let's
think
say
we
they buy a
lost
thousand.
Oscar. I hope Oscar is feeling okay. He is in Israel right now, and there is a I think there was very interesting to do a podcast of such in the times where we are living right now. We are on March 19th 2026, where the war is still going on, and of course our podcast is going as well. And today my guest, who is normally live in Miami but happened to be on a business trip to Israel, got stuck there, and we didn't want to miss each other, so we continue on with the recording and with the podcast. So, so for you, the audience, again, Oscar Hedaya, and Oscar is a the founder of Space Safe, meaning that they create a safe that is digital, that is well structured, that is being used at a wide variety of application, where it gives the businesses and the users quite the flexibility, quite the safe way of having a safe in the environment that you're in, either your house or your hotel or your business that you're in. I love the innovation that went into this product. This product has not been innovated for many, many years. And for those of us who ever been at a hotel somewhere where you see a safe, and it gives you a digital code. You can set your own digital code to engage or to engage with the safe. You know that there is a label on that safe inside of the safe. Sometimes they put it inside, sometimes they put it outside. Do not leave anything valuable in the safe. So it defeats the purpose of having the safe, to be honest with you. I feel like this is a product upgrade that is well needed, overdue, I guess, in some cases. Way overdue of needed of upgrade, and I would love to get my hand on one. I gotta say, I'm worried a little bit about right now about Oscar and his situation where he is. I hope he's at an Airbnb, by the way, and the Airbnb that he's living in, it has a bunker underneath, so he can go directly into the bunker. He doesn't have to travel across the street or walk across the street to get to a safe place. But I do hope that he's okay. I know when I was just talking to him earlier, they received an alarm on their on his phone, alerting him of an incoming missile. So just want to make sure that he's okay. In the meantime, for the audience, if you can keep Oscar in your wishes, hopefully in your prayers, hopefully he's safe where he is. Thanks so much for doing that. Appreciate it. Again, I continue to wait here, but I do believe that this call, it has ended. I don't believe Oscar is coming back to this call. I do hope he's safe. I feel like Oscar right now is busy fending for himself, and hopefully he's okay. But at the same time, I just want to wrap it up here for my guests and make sure that we are we're good for this particular episode. I think we're on episode 191. For Oscar, first I want to make sure you're safe. Whatever your the alarm is finished, if you're okay, please send me a message to confirm that you're all right. I just connected with you on LinkedIn. You've got my contact information. Just send me a little text telling me you're okay. We're worried about you. Hopefully you're fine where you are. Oscar, I genuinely really enjoyed the conversation that we've had today. Most of the guests on this show, we talk a lot about language, about content, but you came from a completely different angle, the physical product, the hardware, the legacy category disruption. But the thread that runs through all of it is the same, is the world moving faster than most incumbents can admit. The founders paying attention are the ones who are building what's next. Thank you for joining me today, Oscar, on the Localization Fireside Chat. And I hope that you are safe where you are. And for the audience, I hope you keep Oscar in your prayers to be safe, to come back home to his family safe and sound. Thanks so much, and I will see you at the next episode.